accession number 27075 reel 2.
Squadron Leader Leggett, reel 2. Obviously, while you were with Hawkers, the Hurricane was introduced and you worked on it. Mm. What were your initial impressions when you saw the designs for the Hurricane?
When I first saw Hurricane, you mean? Mm. Which would have been my impression was yes, this was something new, exciting, but at the initial construction stage it didn't look very different from all the things we'd built, the biplanes we'd been building, because the method of construction was almost identical. Steel tubes for all the whole of the fuselage frame, high tensile steel, which was rolled for the wing spars and the tailplane rudder main spars. So yes, the impression I had was that it was a natural successor to the biplanes we'd been building for years. It was only when we started putting the stringers putting on fabric covering before it began to look like another piece altogether. I think the most impressive part of the construction, of course, is the area immediately around the cockpit and the wing stubs, because the outer wings, of course, were detached in one piece, and that left a stub in which was located the undercarriage, which would come up into the recess that was formed under the cockpit, and then when we put the thing up on stilts and put the undercarriage in with all the pumps, and then filled it up with oil and started pumping the wheels up and down. This was an entirely new innovation. So yes, from that point onwards, it was a very different aeroplane. But in the early stages, it was just almost another heart.
You say with the new innovations, was this Hawker's first monoplane?
Yes, I rather think it was. It was certainly Hawker's first, although they had built an earlier idea for the Hurricane as a seaplane. But I'm not sure that it was ever completed. I've seen pictures of it, and it was a slightly gull-winged affair. With seaplane floats. It was certainly a monoplane. Now, how far it ever went, I don't know. I have a feeling it probably never flew. Either that, or it was simply the design that was submitted to the Air Ministry and rejected. I'm not sure.
And with the Hurricane, what was the first Hurricane? What was it powered by?
Well, that was the Merlin. Always was the Merlin right from the outset, yes. Yes, the Merlin. And then, of course, it went on, developed. A few more horsepower being added all the time. And then, of course, trying to think of the name of the engine that succeeded the Merlin.
It would be the Griffin.
Griffin, that's right, Griffin engine. Yes, the Packard Merlin came along, and then the Griffin. I think Packard's also built quite a few Griffins, as far as I know. Mm. But the Mark 9, of course, was the big leap forward when we'd been stoozing around in Mark 5s, which I mean, let's face it, Mark 5, Spitfire was a good aeroplane. But the 190s were also good. So it was the Mark 9 that made the big difference and gave us that boost that got us up high where we could deal with them.
Because obviously with the Spitfire, that had a continual development. Was that possible with the Hurricanes?
No, not really. No. Well, I say no, not really. I dare say with the best will in the world it could have been done. But strategically, Hawker's job was the Typhoon.
So at the point where you were at Hawker's, what were your living conditions like? What were you still living at home? Or?
Yes, I was. Amazingly, I was. At Wembley, I used to go from Wembley to Kingston, would you believe, which involved changing three trains in the morning and three trains in the back in the evening, and Saturdays as well, believe. In those days, we used to work on Saturdays until midday. So I'd take three trains all the way to Kingston for a couple of hours and turn around and come back again. Crazy. That's what we did, yes.
What was the pay like?
Oh, minimal. I think it just about covered one's morning tea, I think. No, students weren't very well paid, I'm afraid.
And how long were you expected to stay like that? How long was your terms of contract as a student?
5 years, I think it was. About 3 or 5 years. Yeah, I rather think it was 5 years.
And at that stage, what would happen then? What would you be promoted to a specific role, or would you stay with the company, or would you?
Yes, of course, it would depend. I think it would depend on one's performance and on the company ideas of how best to use one. Most students, when they'd finished their tour of the factory, would go to the drawing office. That's where I wanted to go. So some became stress men, but others went into online management in the various shops. My choice would have been the drawing office, yes.
You mentioned that incident where you put the spark plugs into the Napier engine.
Oh, yeah.
Was there much trade union activity within the company at that stage?
Yes, there was. Possibly not so much so in the experimental department. I think there were rather a higher level of employee in there. They'd certainly be more highly skilled because most of the bits and pieces they were making from hand with raw materials, whereas production line, of course. Jigs and tools of all sorts would be used for bending bits of metal into all sorts of shapes. But in experimental, it was all straight from the drawing onto a piece of metal. Got lost now.
What were the kind of range of trades that would exist in the factory?
Oh, in the factory as a whole. Well, there would be skilled craftsmen who could produce a piece from raw material, working strictly from the drawing . And of course, there'd be the machine shop, all the various people, millers and lathe operators, drillers, all beavering away. There would be metal workers who, in those days, all the metal panels, which were made of aluminium or duralumin, all the panels would be beaten out by hand. The noise, of course, is indescribable in the, the tin basher's shop, as it was called. There'd be electricians, of course. There would be people who knew something about hydraulics. There'd be fabric people who were skilled at putting the fabric on the aeroplanes and doping
Could you describe to me that process? Because I'm not quite sure about how this the covering is put across an
air. How you put it on? Well, the Hurricane, of course, was a mixture of ancient and modern almost. We had the steel tubular construction, and then on top of that was placed the wooden framework, which was fairly lightweight, but it attached to the steel frame, nuts and bolts. And then the fabric people would come with their great lengths of stuff and simply chuck it over the top. And they're dressmakers, really. It would all be done by hand, and the fabric would be pulled down into place and stitched. And it was all stitched together. That was at our end of the business, where we were doing practically everything by hand. Down at Brooklands, though, where the production was going on, they would no doubt the fabric pieces would come to them already cut out, just as if one was making a suit. They'd all be cut ready to size and placed over the wooden framers and stringers and stitched into place, and then they go into the dope shop where they'd be sprayed, and lo and behold, this lovely aeroplane would suddenly emerge.
What are they actually spraying it with in the dope shop? What is the doping mixture?
Acetate primarily, but I don't know what the breakdown would be. No, I don't know.
It was
dope as far as we were concerned.
But it was obviously very durable.
Oh, it would be. Yes, it would be. I think. Yes, from time to time during an aircraft's life, it would be re-doped, no doubt. But one wasn't conscious that aeroplanes were being doped all the time. In fact, once they're out in the squadrons, they would only be doped occasionally when they went for second line servicing.
And with the Hurricane, you described obviously the very primitive cockpits that existed within the biplanes. Mm. Was there any innovations in the Hurricane's cockpit area or for the pilots?
Yes, the big innovation was the blind flying panel. This was an innovation. In the old biplanes, you would have an altimeter and an airspeed indicator and a rev counter. They'd just be randomly dotted around the cockpit. In a position where they could readily be seen by the pilot. With the Hurricane and everything else that followed, including most of the bombers, I think we all had much the same blind flying panel, which was six instruments, and it was about that big, I suppose. Airspeed indicator, altimeter. Artificial horizon, directional gyro, rate of climb and descent, slip and ball and see what the hell was it called? Anyway, it was a bubble in the ball. What was it called? Anyway, there it was, six of them, and that was standard for all aircraft from that point onwards, which is a jolly good thing, because at least one could hop from one type to another without too much difficulty, whereas obviously if the instruments were scattered all over the place, it would take a little while to work it all out. But I think I'm quite sure the wonderful girls in the who did the ferrying, what were they called? I forget now. These are the girls who ferried aircraft from the manufacturers' airfields to the maintenance units and to the squadrons. And these girls could hop into any. They'd be given a pilot's notes and told, go around and read that. And then when you do it, go up and there's an aeroplane flight down the North Weald. And they did too. These girls were absolutely amazing.
So that was introduced at that point, was it? That so that was not only for the Hurricane; it was for all
that instrument panel. That's right. It was. Yeah.
So prior to that, it'd really been at the manufacturer's whim as to where the instruments.
Well,
were
I think yes, I think probably the manufacturers put it where they thought. No doubt, somebody from the air industry come along and say that's all rubbish movement.
And obviously, with the Hurricane. Had the armament of the aircraft changed from the biplanes that you'd worked on? Mm.
Yes, they had the biplanes. They had two 303 Vickers machine guns, one either side of the nose, where there was a rear seat, a gunner in the rear seat, he'd have a Lewis gun, which was the thing with the magazine, the round magazine you slapped on. Mm.
And with the Hurricane's propeller, was there any difference in the propellers from the biplanes?
Oh, yes. All the biplanes had two blades, two-bladed propellers. Some would have been metal. I think most of them were wood, though. It wasn't until the Hurricane and Spitfire came along that we got three-bladed propellers. Now, initially, the first Hurricanes did have a big two-bladed wooden prop, but that was only because the three-bladed one wasn't ready. And then from then onwards, three blades were the standard. And I think now that de Havilland, yes, that's right, when the first constant speed unit came in, and de Havilland's did their own design, which was a metal one, three bladed, but that disappeared and was overtaken by the Rotol. Three-bladed, much more impressive prop altogether. They were made of wood.
Can the propeller, obviously the number of blades on a propeller, does that significantly
well, it would depend on the, yes,
of the aircraft?
It was a question of the power of the engine, how many blades were necessary to absorb this power. And so it was stepped up from three, it went to four. And then as the marks increased, so more blades would appear until we in fact did finish up with a six-blader contra-rotating. I don't think it was used operationally very much then. In fact, I don't even know it went to squadrons, but it was certainly about the six-blader. Sometimes you'll see them standing outside airfields at the entrance to a disused airfield, probably.
And with Hawkers itself, did you feel that Hawkers was in the forefront of aviation, world aviation?
Oh yes, very much so. Mm. Yes, we did have the world's first. Let me think. What have the Americans got at that time? Well, they did have monoplanes. They had the early Curtiss. They had the Curtiss biplane fighters, very widely used by the Americans. Now, whether we were first to put monoplanes into operational squadrons, no. I think the Americans had got monoplanes, but they were relatively low powered. They weren't anything like the same class as the Hurricane. The French, they had one or two monoplanes, and the Poles, they had a high wing monoplane, and of course the Germans had got their Messerschmitts coming along.
How aware were you of these developments worldwide at the time?
I always used to take the Flight Magazine, of course. This is my weekly Bible, Flight Magazine. So I would be informed in flight what was happening in the aviation world in general. And, of course, this would include anything to do with Messerschmitts, Although with a lot to do with airspeed records, this seems to be the main preoccupation of manufacturers in those days. They've got to have the world airspeed record by hook or by crook. And indeed, the Italians succeeded quite well with their Mackie. I think most people in my category who were interested in aviation pretty well kept abreast of what was going on.
It must have been very exciting, that period, as well.
It was, yes. Oh, yes. But again, although there was a war looming, we didn't take too much notice of it beyond being rather excited that there was going to be a war, you know. It wasn't seen in any other light. There was going to be a war, it seemed, and with any luck, we might get into it, yeah.
Could you tell me how Sydney Cam was regarded?
By myself as he wore the crown. Oh yes. I have come across odd statements from time to time that he was rather a hard man. I think he probably was. But then I suppose when you want to stay at the top, you've got to be fairly hard, particularly in a world as we lived in, where there was a lot at stake, and there'd be a lot of different opinions, and there'd be all sorts of directives coming from all sorts of directions, all sorts of would-be purchasers would be bombarding one all the time with their ideas about what they wanted, and if you can build it, go ahead, and so on and so on. So I think one's got to be pretty tough in that environment. And I suspect that Sydney Cam was. He was an unsmiling man. I don't think I ever saw him smile. He took life pretty seriously, but then of course he had to. I don't think there was any animosity. I was never aware of it. You never heard people grumbling, "Oh, ruddy Sydney Cam," or anything like that. I think he was regarded as, he is our chief designer, he knows what he's doing, and we'll do our best to produce what he wants.
And as a designer, and with your interest in aviation, what was your opinion of his design work?
Of his design work, my opinion. Well, it couldn't go wrong. the Hurricane was the apple of my eye, let's face it. I wasn't all that enthusiastic about the first Tornado. The Hurricane was the aeroplane. Tornado was something for the future. It was only half built at that time when war broke out. The first one was only just being trundled off down to the airfield. So the Hurricane was the aeroplane, that was the one. Yeah,
at the time, had you seen or heard about the Spitfire?
Had I heard? Oh, yes. But only obliquely. One didn't know much about it. And indeed, I was in my back garden the week of the last Hendon air display, and a Hurricane, the prototype Hurricane, went over at about 5,000 feet, I suppose, and that was recognisable. And then this other blue thing went past, and I didn't know what it was. It was another monoplane, and it had a slightly different noise to the Hurricane, and it was a different shape, quite different, and it was indeed the prototype Spitfire, although I didn't realise it at the time.
Because I don't know, was there any rivalry obviously between Supermarine and the Hawker at that
point? Oh, I think there must have been, yes. Not at my level though. I think the Spitfire was just something that Vickers were doing, you know, Supermarine were doing. I don't think we took very much notice of it, really. we'd got the best aeroplane. If these people wanted to come along with their little toy, that was up to them. We weren't very interested in it. Even that attitude prevailed even to the beginning of the war. I can distinctly remember my first real contact with Spitfires was when I went to Montrose to the advanced flying school, and that would have been in May 1940, and we were learning to fly Masters, which was the advanced machine of the day. And at the end of the airfield, there was a hut outside which stood three Spitfires. But they were way down at the far end of the airfield. We never bothered to wander down and have a look at them. They were just down there. They were rather silly little things, I think we used to think. They got this little narrow undercarriage, you know. And they weren't terribly impressive. Until one day we were sitting having our wings examination, and I heard a roar of something and glanced up, and the Heinkel 111 was coming straight over the top, about 2,000 feet. And at the moment, and at the same instant, a stick of bombs came down right across the middle of the airfield. Fortunately, the last one stopped about 100 yards before he reached the building we were in. And that was followed by a rat-tat-tat from the machine guns. And it was these Spitfires getting onto this Heinkel's tail, and indeed they shot him down. But no, I don't think there was no rivalry. I think it was indifference more than anything. You know, it wasn't until later on that one became aware of the fact that Spitfire was a very good aeroplane.
So I take it then that company loyalty.
Well, I think so.
A big part in.
Yes.
Were there any other aircraft that you can think of at that period that you may have worked on that we've not discussed?
No, it was just those three, the Hurricane, well, the all the early biplanes for all the various countries, yes, and then the Hurricane, of course, and then the very first, the original Tornado, which then became the original Typhoon, and then, of course, the war broke out, so off I went.
Well, prior to the war, did you have any perceivable view of the factory gearing up for war?
Yes, because we had the new erection building, new assembly building, was opened at Langley, Buckinghamshire. Langley, where is it, near Slough? And that was opened. Yeah, war broke out in September. I think that must have been opened probably during May or June, something like that. And we were all trundled out in buses to Langley, where the Hurricane production line was really being stepped up, and it was a brand new building built on mass production line to accommodate mass production. And yes, the line was beginning, so we got the first almost complete Hurricanes up near the door, and then as you went down the line, until you got down to the very far end, where there were pile of steel tubes being put together.
With that production line, how long would it take, really, to get from
to get from one end to the other? I wasn't there long enough really to discover. No, I wouldn't like to say, but my guess, 4 or 5 months, might have been better than that.
It's certainly a contrast from the description of the first working conditions.
Oh, indeed. Oh, yes, totally different. Yes. Oh, it was a brand new building and built for the job. The managers had proper offices instead of pokey little cubby holes here and there. It was a concrete floor instead of wooden boards we had at Kingston. Yes, it was another world. And, of course, we had the airfield.
Would the aircraft be tested from the airfield?
Yes, they're all test flown from there, yes. Brooklands, I don't know what happened to Brooklands. I would imagine that all production was ceased there. I don't really know. Vickers, of course, were very much in the lead there. They were building the Wellington there, of course. So I would guess that, yeah, I would guess that Brooklands, as far as Hawkers were concerned, was more or less being folded. But of course, that was where all the test flying had taken place, and indeed where the first Hurricane was test flown by George Pullman. And then, yes, once production got underway at Langley, the test pilots were all being based there.
Sounds a very big change from what had occurred before at Kingston.
Oh yes, it was another world. Yeah.